That's a good simile, isn't it?
Yeah.
I sent an album to Warren Balfour, Mark.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if he's got it yet. I sent it a couple of weeks ago, but I'm interested in his view. Because what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to find out if that guy
Just be quiet just for a second while I just check a line check. Just be super, super still and quiet while I just check something. Yeah, that's cool. Anyway, carry on.
What were you saying about Walfer? Warren Balfour.
Yeah, Warren Balfour. I sent it to him, and I'm rather hoping if he gets in touch, I want to chase it up and see if he can find out. You remember the guy that did us two excellent reviews of our albums over the years? You know, sort of really gone mad. What's his name?
In America? Oh,
yeah, America. He came to see us when we were in New Orleans. And I can't think of his name now, but I've got runoffs of his and reviews somewhere. You remember when we did? Certainly when we did Flight of Fancy was Benny Green had a radio program, but those after certainly Have You Heard?
Yeah,
there were certainly two of them. I think that must have been Have You Heard and the Abbey Road ones.
Right.
But he did some excellent reviews, you know.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of stuff.
It's been so long, and, you know, is he still alive?
That's what I'm thinking. Wanted to find out.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, I know on one of them, I got it out the other day, I know the thing he wrote, I think it's called All That Jazz, right. USA or something.
Okay.
And we could probably find out, you know, and then put it through.
I suppose what we could do is send it to jazz critics America.
What's the name of said he was doing that? Chris Hodgkins, you know, on his radio program, right. But he might not have sent an album.
It's frustrating that CD didn't get to Steve Crocker.
I definitely sent
that, and I sent it recorded delivery as well.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. I've got it for him to sign for, but then it depends on when he wants to go down to the post office to pick it up. Do you want to let him know that it was sent?
I will do, but that might be why he didn't get it, because he wasn't in. And when I sent my original one, and maybe they've left a card and he's not seen it.
Yeah. Oh, he can't be asked to go down. Yeah, probably
maybe it's that.
Yeah.
I doubt it, but we'll see.
Yeah, do you want to let him know that I sent it yesterday and it's gone to be signed for, which is not ideal. The other one is I would have sent it the other thing where not signed for, it's tracked.
Yeah.
When you put it in for tracked, that would have come to £8.50 to send it.
Really?
I probably should have done it. But guaranteed there, it's tracked, you know.
Yeah, I don't know.
But let's just hope that he doesn't say he hasn't received the second one.
If you gee him up,
and I put a little note in it as well, said, you know, sorry, this has happened, and look forward to seeing it at the end of the year. And I just sort of said, you know, I'm really, very interested and intrigued on the Ellington project.
Yeah, that could be really good. So that's going to be next year, right? Mm-hmm. That's, what's it called again? The Queen Suite, is it?
Well, it is whatever the name they put it, but it was one that he wrote for the Queen.
Right.
And you said it's property of Buckingham Palace or whatever.
I think the story is that the Queen met Count Basie. Is it Count Basie?
No, Duke Ellington.
Duke Ellington. In Leeds.
In Leeds,
of all places.
That's right.
I don't know where or what app, presume some gala or concert. And they struck up a conversation, and apparently they got on quite well. And then when he went back, he wrote a suite and recorded it, but they only ever pressed one copy of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent it to the Queen. And as far as I know, from a little Google search I did, it now resides with, whether it's at Buckingham Palace or, you know, she had it, and obviously now Charles will have it. And he only wrote it for her.
Really?
I mean, it has been recorded since, Steve was saying, and we can get the parts. But
well, in that stream, which I checked out further down on your emails, is that there was a name of someone mentioned that with the Union Big Band, the Union Orchestra.
Yeah, something like that.
That actually recorded it. So Steve said himself, so there must be some parts knocking around.
Yeah, there will be some parts. So that'll be good for us to do next year. off the back of the album. But this year's quite busy anyway, because what have we got coming? You're doing a Hull on Thursday, aren't you?
Yeah, Thursday night.
How's that coming along? Is it ready?
Yeah, I think we are ready. I'm really looking forward to this. This Thursday is good. I'm really pleased with the way it's coming together.
Yeah.
Especially this one, because I want it to be good for Rob, who's one of the members. You know.
Yeah.
And it's the first one for us as well. And importantly, there's a youth jazz orchestra, you know, supporting us.
Oh, good.
Sort of doing a spot in the first half, which is
nice. Which so they're playing first, and then DJ will play second,
and then we're following on.
That'll be good for Rob for Rob's students.
Well, it's Rob's students, yeah. I presume. It's Rob directing.
Yeah, and probably Mike Brown knows some of those kids as well.
I think he will do. Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be good. I'm sorry I can't make it, but, you know.
Yeah, I'm sorry that Mike's not in, because I see he's not in the trumpet section, so he must have something else on.
Okay. But that'll be a good one. And then it's the Big Ears, the Earl, on 21st of April?
21st of April, yep.
All right.
A Sunday afternoon. Perfect.
Yeah.
So I rather hope that...
How many gigs do you think we've done at the Earl over the years?
Oh, good Lord. We did our first concert in there, and they've been mostly annual. You know, I think we only sort of missed one for COVID.
Right.
But we started in 75.
Yeah, so underneath? I remember going as a kid, a really young kid, and it was like, I think it was at the back near the car park, and it was underneath, and it had these metal columns.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have a clear view of the band, you were like looking around a column. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. And we used to do a jazz club on a Sunday lunchtime, once a month.
That's what
and that was in what they referred to as a Concord suite.
That's it, yeah.
Downstairs. With easy access through the fire doors, I remember. Yeah. And the fire escape, the same famous fire escape was there where we had the lovely photograph taken
of
the band.
That photograph of the first album is this fire escape to
from
the Earl of Doncaster Hotel.
Which, of course, doesn't exist now because they've extended the car park.
So there is really a massive history between the Earl of Doncaster and Doncaster Youth Jazz Association, Doncaster Jazz Orchestra, and now Doncaster Jazz Alumni.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It certainly is. And through the good thoughts and the feelings of goodwill that the manager had, the owner,
Graham
Roden. And he was really very good. He initially didn't charge us at all, but I think his underling, his manager, decided at one time that they ought to charge us something. Yeah. But they've been really very generous, and we're delighted to still be doing concerts at the Earl.
It is good.
Because it really is a good venue.
It is. Graham was always supportive. Do you remember when it was my generation playing years later? We did those dance band gigs.
Oh, that's right.
Remember those? We only did a few of them.
Friday nights.
We probably did, I don't know, half a dozen. Mm. And what he wanted to do was like get, get ballroom dancing going again.
But
it is a ballroom essentially where we always play upstairs. And I remember I was probably about 15, 16. That was like our first foray into pro gigs because we got paid. I mean, it might have been 20 quid or something, but you know, to someone who's a teenager in the 90s, that was a lot of money. Well, it was decent money to play.
It was good. It wasn't every week. It was a Friday night, once a month. Friday night was dance night.
And
that was wonderful. And Graham Roden, bless him, on occasions he would sit in on sound. He was very good in that, and he so wanted to do it and to pay tribute. And we've done various big band engagements like that, particularly to sort of celebrate, VE Day and various other things that have happened in history. And
do you remember when I think it was at the Civic Theatre, and you dressed up as Glenn Miller? And everyone was in army. I don't think I was on that gig. I've just seen pictures of it. I don't think I was there.
No, you weren't on that. No.
But everyone was dressed up in proper army apparel.
Yeah.
And you were dressed up as Glenn Miller with the glasses and everything.
That's right. We were loaned some instruments from, I think it's Wellington Barracks, in Bulby.
Right.
And I'd already got a uniform for my formative world.
Yeah.
And... But yeah, so we did that, and we also did that at the Earl for Graham Roden. I think we did the first one there.
Did you do that?
That was a VE Day
right.
celebration. But the important thing is, you talked about your foray into that, you know, as a younger player, is that it was really good training.
Yeah.
And for the actual pieces you played, because sometimes there was quite a lot of sight reading. You had a chance to sort of test your sight reading, you know, on the spot there, and there's a discipline in there in sort of keeping quickly between the two pieces, so there was no time to sort of to hang around. You had to be quick from one piece to another.
Yeah.
So it was.
I remember. Was it Jimmy Lally stuff?
Jimmy Lally, that was.
So
the famous
we had
name.
These arrangements, and obviously. Usually when we played in your bands, you'd have your music and it just looked like any other music, probably 2, 3, maybe 4 pages long. But these were kind of like, what do you call them? Medleys.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have maybe 5, 6, 7 songs in one piece of music, but they would always repeat and you would always have a different part to play on the second line, on the second way through. So you'd have... And it was really, it was looked like piano, you know, like when pianists play, you've got your left hand and your right hand. So you've got two staves running concurrently. So you'd have to learn to jump down 2 staves instead of 1, like you would in a normal piece of music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I remember always messing that up or just finding it difficult. The second thing that was difficult was you never got a rest on your chops.
No.
So it was really good training for your kind of your gig. What's the word? Stamina for brass and woodwind, because obviously brass suffer more, you know, with problems with embouchure when you're playing than woodwind do. But I remember thinking, this was you'd be playing and you think, oh please, I just need a bar off, just one bar, and then you'd be into the next tune. And also because we had to put loads of vibrato on because we were trying to emulate that
particular period,
that sound, we would all be like. You know, put massive vibrato on, which I think probably makes it harder to keep the chops in check.
And I can remember sometimes when they would all exaggerate that to pieces.
Yeah, I think we're all guilty of doing it too much.
But the concept of those particular parts was it was always an intro. I have to sort of say to all of them that those new to it is intro, top and bottom line, and then modulation. You know, you've got to change the key at the end.
Yeah.
And more often, certainly... The less experienced players, we would get to the, we'd go to the top and bottom line, as you quite rightly said, and then get to the, just before the modulation, we would resolve into something sensible and stop there, because the changes of key were sometimes monumental and was a real challenge to all players.
Yeah.
And so we would do that. But as we got better, we brought in the changes of key because we wanted
that's
to do the piece
hard
properly.
For kids, is remembering the key. Oh, yeah. I still forget keys now.
Happy times.
All the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember those. That was good times. I felt like we were really active in that period. And then we got the Jazz Centre. And why did you... You know, so before there was the Jazz Centre, it was Northcliffe. No, it wasn't. It was Wheatley Hills Middle School, was it?
No, the first started at the first group, basically, at the Music Centre in Wath-upon-the-Dearne.
Right, or Wath-upon-Dearne,
as you sometimes say. Whatever you'd like to say, I used to sometimes say, yeah. But... yeah, at Wath Grammar School, as was then, because I was first employed in the old West Riding of Yorkshire.
What was that school called? Is it on a certain road?
Well, I can't remember the road now, but it was Wath Grammar School at that time.
Did you ever rehearse at a place named after a road or a street or something? I seem to remember.
Oh, no, you might be referring to Schofield Street.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
that's it.
From there, a very good man. Who could say this evening that we were having some slight difficulties in the music service because our small, at that time, sort of 7-piece learner jazz band was becoming quite popular.
Right.
Quite a lot of the youngsters want to, if they couldn't play in it, they wanted to come and listen to it. So it was having an adverse effect on some of the other important ensembles, you know, within the system.
What, you mean they didn't want to go to them and they wanted to come to your jazz
band?
Well,
they were actually coming to our rehearsal when they should have been going along to the orchestra or to another group. But we sorted that because a certain gentleman named Keith Jowett, my partner in crime at that early stage, he was head of Don Valley Further Education.
Right.
And he said that he could find me a room And they said, but can you find me a room with a piano? And he said, oh, I can get a piano. And he said, I've got two rooms too. And we could probably have a younger band in one room. And, so he provided a situation. It was, it was the Schofield Street Further Education Centre in Mexborough.
Right. I think that's the one I remember.
Yeah. Well, you'll probably remember
being... We used to go there on a Sunday afternoon.
Sunday afternoons. Yeah. Yes.
That's one of my earliest memories. And I must have been, I don't know, three. Maybe younger.
Yeah, I think you were there. Well, when I first started there, you were almost there, but it was your mother that was carrying you at the time, because she's in the first photograph we had sort of taken of... you know, the music centre there.
Right.
But yes, happy times.
Yeah. So then from there, you went to Northcliffe when you got the job at Northcliffe?
That's right. Well, I went through sort of teacher training at Breton Hall, and then sort of was asked if I'd like to apply for the job at Northcliffe School. Okay. It was a school that I was actually visiting as a peripatetic brass teacher.
So they knew you already.
But I knew it pretty well already, and the sort of students. But... that I was traditionally only having 1 hour there, and I was really keen to get in there for a week at a time. So that was the position then. I took up a position at Northcliffe School.
Yeah.
And
that's when it really started, when Dijar really started kicking off, isn't it?
I think it did then, because we were able to get youngsters that came from, certainly from Conisbrough, and some of the members that were coming with me to the music service, you know, as well,
at Wasp Grammar. Right.
So they would join us on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
And sometimes they were transported if they were having difficulty. But it was at that time, interestingly, that, you know, over the other side of the Don, that the schools in Doncaster got to know a little bit about this. So some of the... enterprising and ambitious sort of students felt that they would like to be part of it. So the likes of Mr. John T. Stockdale comes to mind, and Russell Cook and others, and Andy Vinter. But very, very, very happy times.
And they would have got, back in the day, they would have probably got on two buses to get there. I mean, I remember going, obviously not then, much later than that, but I used to have to get two buses and then walk up that massive hill. But you didn't think anything of it. Like drummers would, Jez would do that with his drum kit. We'd get on two buses, then we'd, you know, tramp up that massive hill.
Such
and
a
now
shame.
It's a whole different it's like the kids rock up and the drum kit's there ready for them because someone's set it up. It, you know, it's a different world, isn't it? Such a different world now.
But it is now.
You know, but it was, I remember Northcliffe because it had those quadrangles. And I remember thinking, this is a really cool school because you had these quads and there were like rabbits jumping around freely in the quads and you might have some like a little plantation or an allotment or whatever and then over here there'd be a playground or a little park for the kids. It was cool. I really liked Northcliffe. It was a massive school, wasn't it?
It was a lovely place. I really enjoyed the times I spent there. But you just mentioned the wildlife. Yeah. And you ought to mention that you probably didn't realise that there was a biology department was above my music class.
Oh, they were using
upstairs.
The rabbits?
Oh, no, they had their own sort of animals in the actual, which were breeding.
Right.
And often some of my students be absolutely amazed or worried or laughing at the fact that, Mr. Ellis, look, there's a mouse, and there was a mouse that came regularly. Yeah. That used to run up the door over the handle, the door handle, and down again. Much to the amusement and entertainment of the students.
But again, back then that was just, you know, you didn't worry about mice.
Right,
back
it was all part of life's rich tapestry at that time,
And there was I remember, so there was the big hall where there was the stage where you used to do rehearsals in the evening, but there was another part to it, and it was like, I don't know if it was the old part or the new part, where there was another stage and almost like an even bigger hall. Do you know what I mean? Like there were two.
Oh, yes, you're right.
In a different part of the school.
That's right.
I don't know. Yeah, the north,
There was a hall on the original part of the school, which is the side of the music department at that time.
Yeah,
which we did most of our.
Was that the old part then?
That was the old part, yes. But the new hall over on the other side, near the office side, admin part of the school, that was a lovely room as well. And that was basically the room where we recorded our first album day in 78. And that was Dijar.
And that's the one with the photo of
That's
of
the one
Earl.
With the photograph. And that was Dijar at Northcliff.
Yeah.
As I say, that was our first recording.
Someone told me recently that they saw that album on eBay for £85.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I'd have to go and find some more.
Because you've got some still left, haven't you?
I still have a handful, yes. Yes. But
you make a bob or two there, Dad.
I'm not sure about that.
So I forget who told me. It might have been Sylvain, because Sylvain wanted to get one, didn't he? I think you took him when we went to France.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure someone said they'd seen one for £85 on eBay. I was like, what? Because I've got one. It's not mine. It's Keith Alderson's. He lent it to me. I need to give it him back. But it still says Fox's Music. And I think it's like $2.99.
On the price label.
Yeah, I think it's $2.99 or $3.99 or something.
Oh, God, yes.
But yes, yeah,
$2.99. You're right.
Is it $2.99?
That was really good. So
that was
memories.
In 78.
Then, from then we were recording. Our albums were on cassette. Yeah, life has changed.
I remember those
CDs, and now I believe CDs.
Now we've come back full circle.
Pardon?
Because we've just done a vinyl album.
Oh, yeah, that's certainly have, and that's and what a great pleasure that was.
Yeah. We'll talk about that, I think, in another episode, because I think we need to dedicate a full episode to the album,
really?
To 50 years. Yeah, because it's a big story, I think. But just going back to, like, Dijar back in the day, what do you think are... Have you got any, like, standout memories over the last 50... Well, it's 52 years now.
Oh, well,
or 51 years. Of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Music.
There are so many obviously happy memories and high points. Even in the earlier day, and the more recent ones, we can probably talk about in another time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the building of that and the realization that the youngsters themselves were getting so much fun and enjoyment out of playing and learning, and they really did want to learn and. I can remember starting an LP library, vinyls then, and we had racks and racks of libraries. But I always had a good idea of who was really taking it seriously by those that were queuing up after each rehearsal to bring back one LP that they'd listened to take another, and they would sign them in and sign them out, and it's. Some of those people, they did it all the time, you know, and not naming any, because there were quite a lot.
Well, I think it's probably obvious who those people are, because they've gone on to do some special things. But, like, yeah, we won't name names because we'll definitely leave people out that's not fair. But let's just say there's been a lot of people over the last 51 years that have benefited from all those bands and all those schools and the Earl and everything else to go on to have... like successful careers in music. But also I think there's a lot of people that have just gone on to enjoy music, you know?
It's important for you to say that.
Yeah, because I think it's easy to celebrate, the guys that went on to become pros and have played with this person and played with that person. All that's great, obviously, but there's still loads of people. I still see people now who were in it, you know, round about roughly the time that I was in it, or even before, or even afterwards, who... maybe not pro players, might not even be semi-pro or teaching, but they're playing still.
But they
have an appreciation for playing in a band, jazz music to a certain degree, and they all have happy memories of like working hard as a team, trying to get stuff right. There's loads of funny stories, and there's been relationships, there's been children born out of... Dijar, you know, that's probably the biggest, you know, success, you know, bit of success you could have if you look at it that way. It's actually created humans in one sense, because people have got together through music.
Like you say, quite importantly, not all of them professional or even semi-professional, but do it for an enjoyment, a hobby or whatever. I mean, as I say, a good percentage of our organisation over the years have had totally unrelated jobs, you know, from solicitors to teachers, to whole gambit, I think. And it's that's important that they do. And some of those still retain...
Yeah.
A very high level of proficiency,
as
we know now, because we've got some of those people in the band. Group.
Yeah, yeah.
And
they're in the concert band, or you know, they're playing around town and around the UK, even though they've got a proper job, and they're still doing it at a professional level as well on the side, which is brilliant. You know?
Well, as we say, they got that proper job. As you and I often talk about, because they are the people that some of them are quite professional in their different worlds.
Yeah, yeah.
But are not travelling the length and breadth of the country on motorways throughout the night to gigs.
No, they're
not. To make ends meet.
Living the dream, Dad.
Or as you say, to put food on the table. Pardon?
I'm living the dream.
Still dreaming?
Yeah,
no.
Still dreaming.
And how well you do it, because... it's not easy, but
fun though. It's fun. That's why we do it. That's why all musicians do it. Because it's fun.
Yeah. I can see that at rehearsals.
But we got that from being in your bands as kids. That's where it started. It's your fault. it's your fault. We're all tired, poor, late nights.
You can blame all that on me, so, but the talent that those people have, many with natural talent, but many with
Ooh, I know, to stop you there,
I know,
Dad.
But I'm saying,
have
but
to stop you there.
I know you're going to stop me there, but I'm saying that yes, there
There's
are
no
people
such
with natural
thing
talent.
As natural talent.
Pardon?
There's no such thing.
No, I know you're going to tell me that they work hard at what they achieve.
That's my belief.
Mm?
That's my belief. Well, you have a different take on it, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've seen thousands of kids on instruments, so you're probably far better, you know, versed at whether or not there's talent, natural ability or not. But well, I would say that it's the environment plus a certain mindset, plus things like die jar and the ability to do music on a rig. I mean, when I was in die jar and at school, I was literally, and I was at the music service as well, so I rehearsed, I think, 4 days a week at school, 2 rehearsals with you, and then Friday nights with music service and 2 bands on a Saturday with music service.
Mm-hmm.
So I was literally in about between six and 8 bands a week.
Yeah, I can...
Didn't practice much, only when I had a grade coming up.
Yeah.
And that's how we got better, by playing in bands. And that's what's sad about now, is that that's not available as much now. I mean, those bands I've just mentioned are all still going, but there's not as many kids coming in to do it. But getting back to the talent thing, you think there is an element of, other than perfect pitch, which given obviously perfect pitch is a natural ability. But that can also be a crutch, a handicap in a way, because I remember teaching John Escree, who's got perfect pitch, excellent, amazing, world-class jazz pianist, who's also come through your ranks. And I remember he started playing saxophone when he was probably about 13 or 14. And I think he played French horn as well. And I was teaching him, and he really was struggling to read music, because he was reading a B-flat part because he was on tenor.
Mm-hmm.
But he was reading, I don't know, a D, playing a D, and he's thinking, that's not a D, because he's got perfect pitch. He's like, that's a C. And it really messed with his head. So he could argue that perfect pitch isn't... I mean, it is a natural gift, without a doubt, but it might not always be beneficial. If you're playing by ear, brilliant. If you're reading, it might be the last thing you need.
Yeah, I can accept that explanation, because it can be a hang-up, I think, for some in that situation. But I still have to hang in there and say that I'd only meet you halfway on this discussion, which I think we've partly had ad nauseum for some years now. there are some that there are able to show their talent, whether they've worked hard for it or not.
But that's the thing. I don't think that you can play an instrument well without working hard.
Yeah.
Even if there is such a thing as a natural gift, you've still got to put the hours in.
No, I know.
I think. I've taught a lot of people one-to-one. You taught groups, obviously, and one-to-one. And you've led bands and ensembles through rehearsals and albums and tours. My teaching is literally been like me and someone else.
Mm.
But of all the people that I've taught that have just gone like that, they've all practiced a lot. I know they have because they've told me, the parents have told me, you know, you can hear it. I don't think I've ever taught someone that didn't practice and got really good. But if they had a natural gift, then shouldn't that equate to them still getting good without doing much practice?
Or shouldn't it equate to them sort of having this desire to practice? So they're, you know, that gift that they have is actually telling them things. I mean, it must be strange for someone that's got perfect pitch. And, and I wonder what goes on in those minds when they're nowhere near a musical instrument or something like that.
That's what I mean. You know, probably...
When do they find out that they had that?
Oh, I don't know. Mm. You're asking the wrong person.
I know. Well,
I'm still working on my relative pitch. Never mind perfect pitch. I don't know. I think it's probably just one of those moments where you just... Well, maybe probably the first time you sit at an instrument, whatever it is, and someone says, that's a such and such, and you make that, you know, that equation then. I don't know. You have to ask John Escreet.
You know, it's you were talking about the way the situation is now. I mean, we've talked about the sort of band, and I've talked about the halcyon days of, through the 70s and 80s, 90s, and to the present day, that there's always, I've been pleased to say, and lucky in that respect, that there's always been that interest, a group of people sort of coming through and wanting to audition. We've never been too pleased ever on auditioning individuals.
Mm.
We'd rather see them in a group and in a situation and in a working situation. Then you find out a little bit more about the individuals that way as well. Mm. But all of this, the other thing I must point out is that all of the stuff that we've done historically with the Jazz Association, I have always been fortunate enough to have a team of people working with me. It is not a one-man, one-person show because that is such an important part. It's not just something that I say. It's something that I mean because it couldn't work any other way.
Well, I can attest to that because, you know, to some level, I'm, or certainly our family is part of that team, but there is a lot more people. And I've witnessed it since being a kid. Like, there's always been a handful of people around you willing to help to do all the ugly stuff, if you like, while you get to do, you know, the pretty stuff
in front
of the band. And no, I know, and you're always keen to emphasise this point, and that I think that's great because it's, first of all, it's true. Yeah, it is true. And second of all, they're the people that don't get the accolades and the, you know, they're not there on the stage at the end of the concert bowing and stuff like that. But I think, you know, that's been part, like you say, that's part of the success of Die Jar is there's been all these people and still are helping out, doing the, whether it's setting up gear or making cups of tea or, you know, driving a bus or providing a van or
being a volunteer member on as a director or a committee member or a board member.
Yeah.
Which that has been...
It has been a massive team effort and still is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that, you know, you can't overemphasize it, but it is important that you do emphasize that all the time because it, you know, some people, it was there. It was probably as important to them as it has been to you. I can think of a few people who gave everything, you know, for Die Jar.
And
still do. Yeah. So you're right. It's not just down to yourself and the kids.
Phil and... Marion Gibbons come to mind. Ron Kettley, who was a legend in his own lifetime.
Yeah, There's loads of people. Again, if it would be, you know, we'd probably forget people if we started listing lots of names. But even to this day, it's, you know, Die Jar's still going very much, albeit not in the centre anymore. But there's still people there doing exactly what we've just been talking about.
And those people are even more vital now because of the atmosphere in which we work. I mean, society, certainly in terms of music education, because it's getting more difficult. You touched on it earlier on. I mean, some of our youngsters are having to, do a risk assessment to leave the house to come to rehearsal.
It's sad.
That's a bad joke, I know, but but I know that it's necessary. But
it's just a shame, isn't it?
Because
when you think about,
you mentioned the buses that you were getting.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was just about to say. Yeah. I mean, back in probably the late 70s when you first went to Nice or wherever it is, did you go to Nice Jazz Festival or whatever?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You probably just rented a bus. Mm-hmm. It rocked up at some place and everyone had a bag and their mums and dads waved them off and off you got. You went on a bus and, probably some kids misbehaved and got some stuff that you shouldn't have done, like we all did at that age.
Never.
But nothing bad ever happened. You know, everyone came back in one piece, with stories to tell and memories for life and friends for life as well. Mm-hmm. And now it's like you say, just to even do a simple thing, even just to rehearse now is difficult.
Yeah.
And it's such a shame. As a dad to a young child, it worries me that your grandkids are not going to get the same opportunities that I had because it's not being facilitated. It's there. Dijar's there. Mm-hmm. Music service is there. The concert band is there, But the kids aren't coming through because the society we live in, and we live in a society now where there's gadgets and everyone wants everything immediately. And I think kids are losing that ability to stick at something that's difficult, which is what playing a music instrument involves. Mm-hmm. They're busy off doing so many things now that music seems to be falling by the wayside. Mm-hmm. It is a shame. And I think you could probably say the same for sport as well. The arts and sport, I think, are probably not where they were 20, 30, 40 years ago.
I think you're right in that respect. But all that you sort of said about the exchanges and the trips abroad, whether it be France, Germany or America, which we were fortunate enough to go, and, of course, Russia.
Russia.
Our trips there. All of those things, and of course, Russia at that time, it was the...
That's the story.
The USSR at that time.
We need to talk about that.
I know there are more stories, I know.
Oh, we need to talk about that. Not now.
Maybe we shouldn't, because it's just even now that you mentioned stories earlier on that are coming back. They all remember these stories, exchanges.
Yeah.
I'm only getting to hear some of them now, because these people that we're talking about, they're now in their mid-40s to mid-50s to mid-60s in some cases, and they're saying, oh, John, you didn't know, but I must tell you. That when we were in Nice,
there's loads of
another story.
There's loads of stuff I did on trips that you probably don't know. Well, you definitely don't know about. But that's part of growing up, isn't it?
Character building.
Exactly. The Russia thing. When you think about that, we'll talk about that in a different episode because that was sketchy.
That was sketchy, and it was a great relief. From myself and Mr. Ron Kettley when we got back onto our own soil.
Yeah.
But great experience was there. But when we look back, there were 40. I'm really quite pleased that I did turn down a trip whilst we were there to Odessa by train.
Was that on the cards, was it?
And that was on the cards. And we found out afterwards it was not the nicest train or journey to go on.
Yeah, well, great trip. I was 15 when we did that. And it was still Soviet Russia, wasn't it? Or it just opened up? It was after the wall came down, wasn't it?
Good Lord, I'm not sure now.
I think it was.
Was it 90?
Yeah, and the wall came down in 89. Mm-hmm. I think it was just about to open up, hence why they were inviting Western bands over there.
Mr. Gorbachev was... was there, bless him.
That was a very, very interesting trip. I think we'll leave it there because...
You wouldn't like to go there now then? No.
Maybe, yeah. I'd go there now. But I probably wouldn't go there with a load of 15-year-old musicians.
I don't think I'd like to go with you lot, to be honest. I don't think them.
We probably won't make it back now. Mm-mm. Anyway, I need a coffee, so I think we'll wrap it up and... Next time I see you, we'll talk about something else.
Okay, well, thanks ever so much. Thanks for your interest. And
thanks for your interest. It's not a job interview. I
know. No, I just want to let you know that this is
thanks for this your is the last.
This is the longest conversation I've had with my son in years. I think I'm going to go for a lie down.
Possibly.
All right. Cheers.
All that best, not that, yeah, and it's not involved discussing set lists and what we're going to wear and
probably not. No.
Stuff like that.
No.
It's been good though. I'll see you again.
Yes, it's been good. I'll see you again sometime. Take care. All the best.
I'll get my people to call your people. We'll figure something out.
Oh, please do. Right. Yeah, I look forward to it.
Cool. See ya. And
cheers. Bye. It's him I feel sorry for. You have to listen to all this claptrap.
Oh, we're at some tangents there, though.
Just a few.